You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks for coming despite the blowing wind and the much colder temperature. But this is a privilege for us to welcome Deputy Managing Director Minju and his team, and at the occasion of presenting a very, very interesting book on the Asian financial system. I won't say too much, but it is one of the hottest topics around and most important topics around. Of course, there's China, but there's the whole of Asia, and I think the financial system, as we've all learned, is one of the absolute requirements for stability and growth. To have a solid financial system is a necessary condition, though it may not be sufficient. Deputy Managing Director Minju was previously advisor to the Managing Director, senior advisor, and he was the deputy governor of the Bank of China, and before that, chairing a working group on financial issues. So there's few, I think, in the world, if any, who knows more about, certainly about the Chinese financial system, but now about the whole world financial system, than Minju, our friend Minju, and he makes us an honor to come to Brookings for this event. So thank you very much. I will cede the floor to him, and after his remarks, I will introduce the panel, and we will have some further remarks from two colleagues from the fund, from our own Eshwar Prasad, and I will then launch a discussion where we will go from a panel discussion first to then having some questions from the floor. Deputy Managing Director Minju, please, and thank you again.
Well, thank you, Kamel, very much for your kind words of introduction, and also for your warm hospitality to hold on this event. So I think it's wonderful for us to come to this place to bring this book to the audience. And also, it's a great honor for me to be here to speak to this very distinguished and audience as well. And thank you, Kamel. And I just realized one thing when I walked in. I thought the Brookings has a very good budget resources. So Brookings probably will provide everybody a free copy of the book. So, because I understand IMF is under always a very tight budget constraint. And, but I realize there's a bookshop there. So everyone, hopefully after this sessions will go to the bookshop line up. I hope, and I think IMF cannot afford to give everybody a book, but probably can afford to give everybody who purchased a book a certain degree of a discount of the book. And hopefully the session is good. Once again, thank you very much for coming to this session. This is cold weather, as Kamel mentioned, and thanks to Brookings for these issues. I'm going to have a sort of background information, sort of set the path for the further discussions. We have a real expert, the authors, will be on the podium to discuss the whole issues. Now, let me talk about a few things about this Asia financial market. The market grow very strongly and fast. If you're looking for, it's very interesting, if you're looking for the Asia, this is, I cannot see it because of glass. If you're looking for here, if I'm allowed to move along, if you're looking for, this is Asia, emerging Asia. The Asia financial shares in terms of global shares really increased 5% to 18% from 2002 to 2013. This is a big, big jump. It's really big. And if you see all those banking assets from 6% to 23%, this is a global share. You will see the Asian financial sector is really gaining the market share in the past 10 years in a very dramatic way. If we add everything together, we will see if we add Japan together, so whole Asia, roughly today, they account 28% of global financial assets. which is quite a bit. And the growth is very impressive, but overall, this 28% is still below the Asia's GDP percent share in the whole world, which is 33%. And with that, you also see the big structure is very much banking dominant. You see, particularly in the emerging Asia, also in China, you will see the emerging Asia, the banking sector, on the GDP is roughly 183% of emerging Asia GDP. And before was 129, but the equity market is only 76% of GDP, and the debt market is 52%. So this one chart really tell us the Asia financial sector, number one, strong growth in the past 10 years, really grow and strongly, particularly emerging Asia from 5% of global financial assets to 18%, China, from 2% of global financial assets to 10% today, grow strongly. But if you're looking for structurally, it very much focuses on banking sector. And the bonds and equity market are still relatively slow. And looking further, the whole financial sector with very strong growth in the past 10, 15 years, still below Asia's GDP shares. So there's still room for continued a strong growth. Put Asia in the global pictures is also very interesting. This is the IMF we call international investment positions. This is the Asia's capital outflow. This is the capital's Asia inflow to Asia. So you will see roughly in 10 years from 2005 to 2015, really the Asia's international exposure increased dramatically. Roughly, Asia exports $10 trillion 10 years ago. Today, $22 trillion. And also, Asia imported roughly $8 trillion 10 years ago. Today, it's roughly imported $17.5 trillion. So, region's international exposure also increased dramatically. But most interesting is here. This is the net position. This net position means how much Asia export capital, how much Asia import capital. The net is $4.35 trillion. So at the net, Asia exports a lot of capital to the whole world. Now that's also a very interesting chart. The chart just say Asia's international exposure increased dramatically in the past 10 years. Net to net, Asia export roughly. Oh, they asked me to not step away from the Mac, I guess. I have to be here. Okay. I saw the IMF. Usually IMF is a very disciplined place, but I tend to moving around. The Brookings is a much more disciplined place, I guess. Not really today. Okay, I will stay here. Yeah. And so you will see net to net Asia export so far, $4.35 trillion to the whole world. And the question is how Asia can utilize this net export capital for the region. I think that's also a big issue. And because of that, Asia exposed to the international spillovers. You will see spillover from roughly advanced economy to Asia, emerging Asias. It's quite high, roughly from 50% equity returns, equity volatilities. And during the crisis, moved to 80% drop down today. It's roughly still around 50%. So Asia's equity market movements is roughly 50% associated with advanced economies spillover. This is also a particular feature for the market as well. Now things also change. If you're looking for today, China, when China becomes bigger and bigger, China's financial assets from 2% global share to 10% global share, and also China played a big role. And China's spillover also have a big impact for the Asia and for the region as well. We compare, it's very interesting, in this chart, I cannot move, I'm sorry. And the blue bar is the U.S. temporary impact for the region, for the equity market movements and the returns. And the red bar is roughly the August episodes, the financial impact from China in August last year. If you compare these two things, you will see there's Malaysia, the Indonesia say, India. And you will see on the currency side, and China have quite a bit spill of impact to the Asian, to the region, almost equivalent to the United States, particularly on the equity side, the movement size. And China today have even big impacts than compared with the tapering impact in 2013. Now, that's also become the new feature of the whole financial sectors we're facing today. Now, this is very much the system, if I sort of will provide this very styled features in the few slides. The more challenges coming from real economy, the real economy is really changing. The whole region changing in a very dramatic way. The first issue is demographic change. You will see the red line is for Japan. You will see Japan in 30 years horizon, in the next 15 years, that people aged over 65 really will increase from 60% to 32%, double in 30 years. So we all move to aging. And also, if you look into the South Korea, since it's the blue line, you will see almost a vertical increase in the next 10, 15 years, roughly from 6%, 7% increase to 24%. So almost a four-time aging increase. This is absolutely stunning demographic change. If you're looking for China, which is a brown line, also from 6% increase to 16% in 30 years horizon. The black line is for the whole world. So compared with the whole world, we're all getting older in terms of demographic structure. But Asian getting older faster and stronger. This is a big fundamental change because when you're getting older, your saving rates will drop. And you will start today, you were looking for the long-term investment instruments. And then compared with the financial structure we had before, when you move to the debt equity market, and the banking sector may not necessarily provide enough product to serve the aging people and aging population as well. This is a profound drive force will shape the Asian financial market and the structure in the future, given the steep of the curve is so big and it's really moved very strongly fast. And there's a huge financing gap in Asia. This is a UN and ADB calculator to meet SDG requirement, how much money Asia needs. Last year is a year of development because we had the year of SDG replace MDGs. We have a climate change. We have a finance for developments in the Addis. Back to the region, we realize in the next 10 years, every year Asia needs $96 billion to fill the remaining gap for MDG, education, healthcare, and other few things. Need another $323 billion to fill the gap for income for the people who live under $2 per day, and need a $718 billion per year for infrastructure investments. How financial sector can help to mobilize the resource from public, from private, to meet its $1 trillion challenge for 1 year in the Asian, to meet the SDG target. That's a big challenge for Asian financial sectors. And meanwhile, if we're looking further, there's an even more tougher challenge the region facing. We're pulling the four major economies, China, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan of China together. We see how much their capital contribute in the growth. You will see, take a Korea case as a dark line because it's clear, the capital contributor grows roughly from 3.5% and it grows to roughly 5.5% and gradually down to less than 2%. Japan, the red dot line, also see the same thing. China capital contributing to growth drop even faster. That means with heavy investments and capital return, particularly marginal return, drop faster than expected. And meanwhile, because the capital contributing to the growth, they also the down panel showed the TFP that's a productivity contributor to growth also drop in quite a dramatic ways. You will see the dark lines of Korea. You will see the Korea productivity increase in the first 10 years and on all the way down grows to roughly less than 1% of contribution to growth in those years. And also you see Japan, the productivity growth very strong in the first 15 years and drop. In China, the productivity growth remained high around less than 4%, dropped dramatically in the past 5 years on the, because the capital efficiency and the productivity, because the R&D innovation, those things have slowed down like that. What does it tell us? This chart tells us that Asia is facing a fundamental challenge, that's to improve the productivity, to raise the productivity growth, to raise the potential growth. This also means to support the service sector, particularly when the region getting mature, move to service sector-oriented economies, to support the service sector productivities, which is the key challenge. And the financial sector should and could play a very important role in this area. But I have to say, this is not easy. This is not easy things. For financial sector to support R&D, to support innovations, to support a startup, to have a more sort of venture capital type of things, become more flexible to fit the market need, to support the growth, to support the sustainable growth, that's a real challenge. Last, not the least, and there's inclusion issues in the Asia. We will see in the region, you will see in the South Asia, the adult have the banking accounts, yes, increased from 2011 to 2014, so roughly from 32% to 46%, but still only 46%. So we will, half of people in the South Asia do not have a banking account. And even in the East Asia, we say roughly 30% of adults still don't have a banking account. So there's quite a big room to improve the inclusiveness in the financial sector. So we all know today, the financial inclusion is a very important drive force for sustainable growth, because it provides financings for individuals, for the SMEs, for the poor families, which will bring the productivity and support the growth. So financial inclusion is also another very important issue. So bringing them together, there's a few recommendations. We put them together looking for the futures, current structure and the futures. And we'll see enhancing financing, deepening and integrations, one, building resilience, and also strengthen policy coordinations in the regions. Now, this is very broad. So let me bring them together. What's the story? I think the story, just as very few 7 to 8 slides, is what I try to say. Is number one, the Asian financial sector grew strongly in the past 10 years. For example, China from 2% of world financial assets to 10%, and reaching roughly to the 28%, roughly from 10%. So really strong growth. But there's still room for the futures, because still the financial assets is below than GDP shares in the whole world. And structurally still remain a banking focused and need to develop on the equity market and the bonds market as well. And the region export $4.35 trillion to the whole world. And the region import $22 trillion, export $17 trillion, which clearly put the region under huge international exposure. And when China becomes bigger and bigger, and China's monetary policy and market movements do have a spillover in capital for the region as well. So that is the financial sector. But with demographic change, I think that's a big one. With the infrastructure investment need increase day by day, and also with the whole economy structure moving to the more innovative, more service and productivity increase become more and more important, and with financial inclusion, still have a hope gap to fill, and the future financial systems for Asia have to look into those issues, have to meet these challenges. And this study tried to understand what is Asian financial structures, try to understand what the area we can do, we should be able to catch up, and what policy need for the region. After 2.5 years hard workers, our staff is here, they produce this beautiful books with red color on the cover. So that's the one. But I don't know why they tied the money. You know, they should have freed the money. I think that's the whole thing. And so thank you once again for coming to these sessions. I hope very much you will enjoy the book. Afterwards, I hope you will buy the book. Thank you very much.
So Mr. Shikahisa Sumi will first complement the remarks of Minju, followed by Cheng Hun Lim. Shikahisa is the Assistant Director, Asia and Pacific Department, and has headed this financial sector project. Previously, he served as Deputy Vice Minister of Finance for International Affairs and Deputy Commissioner of the Financial Services Agency for the Government of Japan. And Cheng Hun Lim is now Assistant Director, Western Hemisphere Department. She reviews the department's financial surveillance work and serves as the Mission Chief for Canada. Canada is one of the successful financial countries, I guess, right? Has that reputation.
Very much so.
But you can always get better. She has had 13 years in the Monetary and Capital Markets Department of the IMF, where she worked on financial crisis and sovereign debt issues, including sovereign debt restructuring, and the development of analytical tools to assess systemic macro-financial risk and bank soundness. Cheng Hun is known for working on the effectiveness in many ways of macro-prudential policies, which, as you know, is one of the big topics in financial market analysis these days. And then we have our own Eshwar Prasad. We have to share him with Cornell University, where he's senior professor of trade policy, but he is much more fundamentally anchored at Brookings, and where he's a senior fellow in the Global Economy and Development Department, and the New Century Chair in International Economics. He's an associate of the NBER, and he was at the fund before, chief of the Financial Studies Division, and head of the IMF China division. So I think we couldn't have hoped for a better panel. So which one of you wants to start?
I think it's going to be me.
Okay, all right.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Dervish. Good afternoon and welcome to this seminar. Mr. Chu has given you a very nice overview of the book. I would like to pick up on one important message from his remarks, and that is Asia's financial sector still has room to grow, and it will evolve to meet the needs of a future generation. That could be for infrastructure financing, as he mentioned, or it could be to mobilize savings for an aging population, or managing a higher volume of cross-border trade or capital flows. So it is very likely that we will see Asia's financial sector become bigger, more complex, and more interconnected. Now, in my next 5 to 10 minutes that I've been given, I would like to talk a little bit about the importance for Asia to anticipate and prepare for these changes. And I will speak from a regulatory perspective. In our view, understanding new products, new markets, and new risks will help Asia build resilience. So, how can Asia best do this? How can it best prepare for the changes that are coming? Well, let's look at what Asia's strengths are and areas where it still needs to work on. What are Asia's strengths? Asia has strong and well-capitalized banks. It has relatively large provisions for non-performing loans. Asia has good compliance with international regulatory standards. Most central banks have a framework to monitor systemic risks through macroprudential supervision. And Asia has relatively robust crisis management frameworks. So these are all very good. But there are areas that Asia still needs to work on. And what are these? So I'm going to be like David Letterman and leave you with a top 10 list of recommendations from the book. And hopefully this will entice you to go out and buy a copy of the book. So I'm going to go through the list very quickly, so listen carefully. First, Asia needs to reduce the large role of government in financial intermediation. I'm not going to elaborate. I may elaborate later, but I'm just going to go through what are the key recommendations. Second, Asia needs to reinforce staff and technical capacity at supervisory agencies. Third, once you have the supervisors, you have to give them the operational independence to make decisions and to enforce compliance. So they need to have authority and willingness to act. Fourth, Asia should continue to improve its surveillance of systemic risks through macroprudential supervision. And here it's important to be clear about the assignment of accountability. Fifth, as financial institutions become more complex, Asia needs to enhance consolidated supervision to monitor funding risks and also to monitor connected lending. Six, while Asian banks are well capitalized, additional capital and liquidity buffers may be needed as the banks grow bigger. Seven, Asia should strengthen its framework to resolve weak financial institutions in a more timely manner. Financial institutions that are no longer viable should be allowed to fail. Eighth, Asia could improve the availability, timeliness, and quality of financial sector data, including the collection of information of non-bank or shadow banking activities. Nine, accounting and auditing rules and practices should be brought closer to international standards. And finally, number 10, there should be greater cross-border cooperation and collaboration to share information and to coordinate on crisis resolution. So this is the top 10 list. As you know, Asia has done a lot in the decade after the Asian financial crisis in 1997 to improve financial supervision and to improve resilience. We think that continuing to work on these financial sector reforms will be important for Asia to preserve financial stability as it transitions to a new growth model. As you know, any transition will always have a few bumps along the road. Good macroeconomic management and financial policies will go a long way to reducing the size and frequency of these bumps. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much. That was very succinct and, of course, long menu, but said very forcefully in a short time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. And thank you very much for allowing us to be here. Well, first, this is not meant to be tying. This is the interlinkage. This is supposed to be the financial sector. I mean, don't blame us. This is what our designer said. This is considered to be the financial centers of the world, and this red thing is an interlinkage between it. So we are not trying to bind the thing. Now, let me add something to the Chen Fun's comments. She is from the Monetary and Capital Markets Department. That's where she used to work. And I'm from the Asia and Pacific Department. And this book is a collaboration of these two departments in the IMF. So we at the APD or Asia Pacific Department look at the countries, and the MCM looks at the financial sector globally. So this is a sort of horizontal versus vertical kind of assignments. And then she mentioned pretty much as the financial sector of the global Asia, I mean the Asia in general. This book also contains the macroeconomic related chapters, like Asia's demographic challenges and the infrastructure needs, or the ASEAN Association of Southeast Asian Nations, financial integration, and the analysis of factors behind the capital flows. So among these, I found that the ASEAN financial integration chapter is particularly popular among the region's policymakers, because it has the, includes the lessons learned from Europe, or you know, something went well, something went not so well, and then what are the things you should be looking at when you're going ahead with the financial integration. So this is the kind of thing that the policy advice is the behind what we intend to provide in this book. So this is the 300-page book. It's reasonably thick, and lots of regressions and model. So this is the more of an academic book. But then we editors tried our best to make it easy to read. So it has a conclusion that the topics or main key takeaways of the chapter at the outset of each chapter, and also at the conclusion at the end of the each chapter. So you can just read it. That these short places if you're sort of time pressured. But having said that, IMF, we are not in the publishing business. So we are to make policy advice to the member countries. So what is more important for us is to make the findings of this book into something tangible, something that the policymakers can use in making their own policies in each country's specific circumstances. So what we are doing, let me talk about, since the DMD Zoo gave you the sort of broad overview of the book, and then we just supplemented it with some detail. So let me talk a little bit about what we are planning to do with the book from now on. Basically, we are planning to make our IMF country teams to learn about the findings of the book and then make them use them in their annual consultation with each member countries. So that's what we are doing. And then particularly, in one of the findings in the book is that Asia's economy weathered the global financial crisis relatively well. But that was because the starting point was solid. Asia has suffered from the Asian financial crisis 10 years earlier. So they did their best to make their books in order. And then when the global financial crisis hit, Asia's economy was relatively better positioned with a relatively conservatively managed the books of the banks. So we didn't have toxic assets too much. So then that resulted in relative resilience of the Asian region in general. But then, during the years that pursued, in a very, very easy monetary conditions and very historically low interest rates, Asia's corporate sector has accumulated quite a lot of debt and increasing the leverage along the way. Now, last December, that very easy money was reversed in one of the major, the largest advanced economies. And then what happens from here? So that's the kind of thing we will be looking at in a great earnest. And the tricky thing here is that the corporate leverage or corporate liability average doesn't say much. Well, if a country A is suffering or struggling, country B has large cash buffers. I mean, it doesn't, and on average, this should be okay, right? Not really. You know, even if on average the bank's corporate sector is okay with repaying the debt, but it's not average. It's a individual country that has to meet the financial obligations. So we are trying to get how much of the percentage of the corporate sector is vulnerable. So this kind of thing we are employing, and we are trying to especially focus on going forward, looking at this each country, each situations. Another thing is that the macroprudential, so far, the macroprudential has been utilized in the context of incoming capital flows. Asia has received quite a lot of capital flows. In the process, the capital flow went into the real estate, and the real estate price went up. So many of the jurisdictions used the macroprudential policy to combat the asset price inflation in the context of the increasing or incoming capital flows. But now, with possibly the reversal of this risk sentiment, and possibly the region will be facing outflow of capital instead of inflow of capital. And at the same time, we are facing with a bit of a softening of the economy. So if the economy softens, we loosen the monetary policy. But if you loosen the monetary policy, then the asset price inflation may be stoked. So that what are we going to do with this monetary policy, conduct of monetary policy? You have to, on the one side, you have to combat the demand management. You have to loosen to accommodate the economic activities. But at the same time, you have to make sure that it doesn't stoke the asset price inflation. So the macroprudential policy's uses in that regard will become very important. And thirdly, the capital inflow will be somewhat more precious in the future. I mean, in the past years, we have abundant inflow into the region. Now, we are not so sure that the capital inflow continues to be lax. So in the years to come, we need to think about more effective use of the capital inflow to perhaps usher the capital into more productive rather than sort of flamboyant or somewhat superfluous, unproductive investments. So how are we going to do it? And many country has its own structural reasons or historical reasons, has certain alignment of incentives. For certain country, because they wanted to encourage house ownership, they may have certain bias toward buying a house rather than saving. So these kind of things may have certain impact on the choice of investment into productive versus non-productive investments. So these are the kind of things, basically, what we'll be looking to within this umbrella of future of Asia's finance project. We'll be looking at in the context of each of the member countries. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Eshwar, looking forward to your comments. And
finance has become the lifeblood of modern economies. Unless you get finance right, you don't get growth right, and you get a lot of volatility in return. So for the most dynamic region in the world right now, despite recent bumps in the road, which is Asia, I think taking a close look at what is happening and what is needed in financial systems is a very valuable service, which this book does very nicely. So in my remarks, which build upon those of the previous three panelists, let me talk a little bit about what's been happening on the ground in Asia, which in many ways is intriguing. Then talk a little bit, building on the themes of the book, about what is needed for financial systems to work well. And then talk about one specific example that I think drives so many of these issues. And assuming there is some interest in China, I'll draw that into the discussion. If one thinks about what happened after the global financial crisis, there was a sense that finance had gotten too far ahead of itself. Interestingly, the year after the financial crisis hit, India introduced an instrument that had not been seen there before, credit default swaps. 2 years after this, China introduced or opened up its foreign exchange derivatives markets. At one level, these might seem like foolhardy moves. After all, it was derivatives markets, and in particular, derivatives like credit default swaps that caused much of the turmoil in global finance. But this speaks not to the folly of these countries, but to the sense that financial market regulators had that there was genuine demand for financial products in many of these countries. And one might think about credit default swaps as having gotten ahead of themselves as toxic, overly sophisticated financial products, but there is a good reason. The economists like to talk about completing financial markets, that is, allowing for financial products that allow for insurance against all the states of the world possible. We don't quite get to complete financial markets, and the problem is that on the transition to complete financial markets, many instruments, if you have the wrong incentives, if you have the wrong regulatory frameworks in place, can cause a lot more trouble than the benefits they bring. But I think what we are likely to see is at some level a convergence between where finance was in the Western world before the financial crisis and where the emerging markets were before the financial crisis with very underdeveloped financial systems. I think the ideal meeting point is somewhere in the middle, a much more well-developed set of financial markets, but perhaps not to the extent that we saw in the Western world before the crisis. And this book very nicely lays out the path. So what are the key attributes that are necessary for finance to work well? I'd argue that there are three: breadth, depth, and inclusiveness. And all of these are touched upon in the book. Breadth refers to the scope of financial markets. As Mr. Minju pointed out in his presentation, Asia still remains very largely bank-dominated. And I think having a very broad set of financial markets can serve a variety of purposes. Not only does it provide more competition and discipline to the banking system in itself, but in addition, it gives savers opportunities to diversify their portfolios. It gives firms other avenues of raising capital. And I think this sort of competition is ultimately going to be working towards a much better financial system. And as Mr. Sumi pointed out, if you have good bond markets in particular, they're not only very good in terms of intermediating domestic finance, but also intermediating foreign finance towards longer-term productive projects. If you take many countries in Asia, again, India being a primary example, there is a crying need for finance in India, but what is crucial is that there be ways for foreign investors to participate in the India growth story, but in a way that also serves India's long-term growth needs, which can be done through bond market development. But you also need depth in these markets, because if you have shallow markets, ultimately you get a fair bit of volatility and these markets don't work very well. So the amount of liquidity, the amount of turnover in these markets is important. And here I think the path many of the countries in Asia have taken towards opening up their capital accounts more does play a useful role. Much has been said about how premature opening up of capital accounts can be a potential problem, and there is certainly truth to that. But I think there is a different perspective that opening up of the capital account in a careful and cautious way can in fact generate what I have referred to in some of my research as collateral benefits. That is, the benefit of developing parts of the financial system through foreign investors' expertise, their money, and their better assessment of risks and so forth. In addition, you do need to have the financial system reach a large part of the economy. If one thinks about the fact that growth in many economies in Asia has been somewhat unbalanced, and if you think about the fact that structural reforms of a variety of sorts have not gotten much traction, part of it is related to the political economy. In many of these countries, it is a very viable and potent argument that many of the benefits of reforms ultimately go to the political and economic elite, who are very well connected, who are able to benefit from the reforms, while the short-term dislocations often end up having costs that are borne by those who are not well tied in. And tying in ends up being very closely related to financial inclusion, because if you're not well tied into the financial system, it becomes difficult to participate in the economy more broadly and to participate from the benefits of growth. So I think there is not only a macro-based but also political economy-based argument that makes financial inclusion a very important imperative. And we've seen again in many countries in Asia, China, India, and so on, the government recognizing this and taking significant steps to improve financial inclusion. So then let me come to the last part of the discussion. And I think China is a very good example of what I think is necessary beyond financial market liberalization and capital account opening. In case you've been watching the news, you've noticed things have been happening in China for the last few weeks and months. My view is that this is not the result of policy mismanagement by China alone, although certainly things could have been managed a lot better. I think the signals actually things proceeding in the right direction. You might say, what the heck do I mean? I think what China has been trying to do is, in fact, to let markets work well. The problem that China faces is that if you try to liberalize financial markets without the supporting framework, things don't go well. What do I mean by the supporting framework? The book refers to needing a much better regulatory framework. But if you think about volatility in the stock market, why is the Chinese stock market so volatile? Part of the reason is that you don't have the good institutional framework to support it. That needs better corporate governance, better auditing and accounting standards, better corporate transparency. If you don't have those, then what happens is that even retail investors become momentum traders because they don't have enough information about the corporations they're investing in. So they tend to get pulled along when the stock market is going up and pulled down when the stock market is going down. And of course, when the government has as its only tool, somewhat heavy-handed government intervention, which looks very haphazard and where the strategy is not clear, that makes things worse. So there has been a great deal of criticism. Some of it, I think, misguided. Some of it, I think, is perhaps more right, that the government is making things worse by trying to intervene directly in stock markets or currency markets. But I think the fundamental issue here is that for financial markets, equity markets, currency markets, bond markets to work well, you need a better supporting framework. So here again, I think the book alludes to these issues, but this is really going to be the core issue in emerging market economies. Not that you need to hold back on financial market development or capital account opening, but make sure that the other reforms in the economy, both real side reforms and institutional reforms, go in parallel. Perhaps waiting for those reforms to take place before moving ahead on financial market reform would be waiting indefinitely. But I think that's where these economies are going to have to go. So I think this book makes a very valuable contribution in terms of honing in on what China really needs, which is better financial markets, and also pointing out what else is needed to support good finance in Asia.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Eshwar. Let me ask one or two questions, and then we go to the floor. One question I have to the group, and you can decide, maybe our IMF colleagues will have the first kind of go, either one or both, and then Eshwar Prasad also. But it's very hard to separate financial sector management from exchange rate management. It's not the same topic, but they're deeply linked by the balance sheets of the corporate sector, by many other factors. And is it a problem that the capital stock or the financial assets stock adjustment that may be happening with liberalization in China particularly, in other words, more capital outflows starting as opposed to inflows, which is, you know, an asset diversification maybe trend, maybe other things. At the same time, as the while the current account surplus is not at the highest levels it's been, but I just saw yesterday that the trade surplus with the U.S. is at an all-time high for China. So on the one hand, you have, you know, a capital outflow that will tend to depreciate the exchange rate, and there's a lot of confusion in the kind of non-specialized press as to what really should be the exchange rate movement anyway. And on the other hand, there is that big surplus, and depreciation, other things held constant, might increase that surplus. How do you look at that problem?
Generically, you know, in the IMF, we have this the external balance assessment, and then we look at each country's current account deficit and surplus and positions, and then try to explain it from the fundamentals and the desired policies. And then we, in each of the countries' surveillance, we come to explain, suppose you, country A has this surplus of like 4% of GDP, but then that is explained by certain factors. And then what is the residual, which cannot be explained by this fundamentals and long-term desired policies? Then we say that look at these the country-specific issues and try to come to into more balance for that particular country. But I'm not in charge of China, and I'm sort of somewhat reluctant to go into China-specific issues as the the China team is currently now in China for the pre-scheduled staff visit, and they will be talking with the authorities probably as we speak. But in each of the country cases, we do look at the what makes that current account surplus as it is, as opposed to what we think the fundamentals of the economy and the desired policy would dictate the current account level to be somewhat different. So what are the differences and why is it happening? And then we usually ask the country authorities to think about why this is diverting from the norm and what can they do to reduce that diversion. So I know I'm not answering your question in the way you like, but that's just how we sort of institutionally.
Well, I mean, let me rephrase it. I mean, maybe for Eshwar, you know, I mean, when you have a system which is liberalized on both the trade and the capital account side, you still get a lot of volatility. But in China and parts of other parts of Asia, you had a capital account that was pretty managed, and maybe the goods account more liberalized, and you have a fairly sudden, or at least rapid, relaxation of capital account management. I mean, and therefore a stock adjustment on the capital goods side. And will that stock adjustment be a challenge to macroprudential policy or, you know, let's say corporate balance sheet? I mean, banks can be very well capitalized, but if the corporate sector has an open position vis-a-vis foreign exchange, for you know, that may not mean very much. I'm not saying that's the case, but I mean, how is the kind of change in capital account policies of China and of other countries impacting financial sector, both analysis and policy? Do you have any views?
I think it's important to remember that since the Asian financial crisis in 1997, Asia as a whole has cut down significantly on its external debt. So there's a lot less foreign currency liabilities on the books of the corporate sector than it was in the past. And this actually has allowed many Asian countries to adopt a more flexible exchange rate. And you saw that that flexible exchange rate served Asia extremely well during the 2008 crisis. It acted as a very effective shock absorber. So I think from an exchange rate policy perspective, we have seen a sort of a very nice transition from largely managed exchange rate regimes to a more flexible exchange rate regimes. And this has served Asia well. From a macroprudential policy perspective, and for those who don't know the term macroprudential policy, I think at the IMF we forget that sometimes people don't, you know these terms. But it's essentially not supervision of individual financial institutions, but supervision of the financial system from an aggregate perspective. So you look at the financial system and you see where are the risks coming. So, you know, it may be that individually, financial institutions may not be at risk, but on aggregate, if there is significant exposure to the real estate sector, for example, that could pose systemic risk to the financial sector. So from a macroprudential perspective, I think it's important also to keep in mind that it is different from exchange rate management. Macroprudential policy is to address systemic risk in the financial system. If there are significant capital inflows into Asia, as we saw right after the 2008 crisis, then macroprudential policy would be the useful tool to use to address exposure of the financial system as a whole to real estate prices or to some other asset class. Now, in the event of capital outflows, macroprudential policy could also be loosened in the event that buffers have already been built. Now, if there are no buffers left, if there's buffers have not been built, then it's important to make sure that macroprudential policy remains where the vulnerabilities or the exposure of the financial sector remain manageable. This might be a long-winded way of saying that I think Asia has a sound exchange rate policy. It's a much more flexible exchange rate regime to absorb shocks. It has, most central banks have a framework for macroprudential supervision, and Asia, in fact, has led the world in terms of implementing macroprudential policies to address systemic risks in the financial system.
Let me force one more time, and then I will stop, but vis-a-vis Eshwar, because he's written, you know, so much on the international monetary system. But we do have, a little bit of a strange situation in the world now from a macro point of view, and it links up with the financial sector. I mean, we have two countries which have very large surpluses, and China was reduced, but it's going up again, and Germany. Okay? Both of these countries are embedded in regions, China in Asia and Germany in Europe, but they resemble each other in terms of the trade position quite a bit. And yet, both of these countries have exchange rates that are depreciating. Whereas in a kind of global imbalances sense, you would hope that they would appreciate. Any thoughts, Eshwar?
So in China is, from that traditional framework, a bit of a conundrum. So the Chinese trade surplus relative to its levels before the global financial crisis has certainly come down a lot, although in the last three quarters it's gone back up to about 6% of GDP, which is high. But the current account is another matter because, this was referred to earlier, China has been experiencing capital outflows. So there is that complex that is being dealt with right now, and the Chinese currency is still managed quite actively against the U.S. dollar. And, of course, the U.S. dollar has risen very sharply in the last year or so, at least until last summer. So in China, you had an expanding trade surplus at the same time that the currency was appreciating in trade-weighted or effective exchange rate terms. And a large part of that was a decline in imports, not so much import volumes, but import prices, because the prices of a lot of China's imports, especially commodities, have been very weak. So the configuration is not easy to map into the traditional sort of configuration that we might think about. In China's case, as your initial question pointed out, Kemal, I think there are some significant challenges. Now, China has been aggressively opening up the capital account, not only to inflows, but to outflows. And in fact, even in the midst of all this turmoil, the official capital account opening has continued, although China has started tightening up on some administrative requirements to limit capital seepage through what it sees as unofficial channels. The problem is that the timing was not ideal, because you have an increase in capital outflows for what I think are very good reasons. Because after all, there are about 170% of GDP worth of deposits in the Chinese banking system, about half which is by households, about half by corporates, and about 10% by the government. And it makes good sense to take some of that money out of the banking system for diversification reasons, and it would provide some competition for the banking system as well. The problem is that the unofficial capital flows, as reflected in the net errors and omissions, have started creeping up at the same time that we have these capital outflows for the right reasons. So you have diversification outflows compounded by outflows that are exacerbated by concerns about the economy and possibly the anti-corruption drive. And this creates very unstable capital flow dynamics, which I think is what the government is contending with. So I think as was referred to earlier, the notion of Asia as a whole shifting towards more flexible exchange rates, which has been good for the region, I think is a story that continues to this day. China is trying to move towards that, but again, without the right supporting framework in place, it just creates a lot of turmoil. So I think what is going to be needed to pull things back is not any more direct intervention in the financial markets or in the equity markets, but really this broader complex of reforms and policies that are going to be needed to stabilize expectations.
Okay, one more question, then we'll turn to the audience. I do remember the London G20 meeting. And one of the big issues, which was partly because of political, but partly real, partly political messaging, was tax havens and information exchange in the financial system. I think it's becoming a more and more important issue from two point of view. I mean, I think there is much more decisiveness in the world to fight against illegal tax evasion. And it's large. The estimates are very large. And second, there is also now increasing decisiveness on dealing with legal tax avoidance issues. And a lot of these are financial sector issues. One sometimes has the feeling that in Asia there is a lot of reluctance to open up the information exchange and to end whatever tax shelters that may still exist. Any views on that?
I think it would be fair to say that the IMF has done a lot of financial sector assessments for the Asian countries. One component of those financial sector assessments is an assessment of the anti-money laundering infrastructure, what you call tax havens and so on. And I think by and large, the results have been relatively robust. There are areas for improvement, absolutely, but I don't think that the findings for Asia are any different from other regions of the world. I think globally, we need to do more to combat illegal transfers of money and as well as anti-money laundering. So I don't think this is specific to Asia alone.
Anybody wants to add? No. Okay. I hope there is, of course, that international movement, but I think if you look at the last 5 years, particularly with the OECD in the lead and also some governments, there is a much more decisive move on that. And I think it would be welcome if various Asian jurisdictions also joined in that movement. It's one of those typical global public goods that, if a large part of the world doesn't cooperate, then you cannot really eradicate the disease. So that's why I'm asking the question. Okay, let's go to the audience now and take a few questions at once, and then there was one who immediately raised their arm in the back there. Please, I do identify yourself before you ask the question. Not work. Yeah, your voice is pretty good.
I know we're talking about trying to look at over the longer term trends, but we can't get to the long term if we don't get through the short term. And it seems to me that I think the IMF, who estimated that the overinvestment capacity of China was something like 25% of GDP, if there are a cascading series of defaults in China, that slows down near term growth, does it not? and causes a massive spillover throughout the rest of the globe. How does China deal with that without causing a nosedive in growth, one? And two, how does Beijing manage the damned if you do, damned if you don't on the RMB valuation? Depreciating it would be allowing greater flexibility while also sending signals to the rest of the world that growth may be a lot worse than they're letting on.
Okay, we'll take yes.
Mm-hmm. Lou Gagliano. Financial markets react to reporting and numbers. So let's assume for the moment that the quality of the numbers in China in particular aren't very accurate. How does that affect some of these projections in terms of the financing need that is required? And there's a big difference if the bogey, the difference between reality and what the numbers are being reported is 10% as opposed to being bigger than 10. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I do want to remind all of us, though, that this is on the topic of the book and not, you know, completely straying away into daily affairs and daily press reports. So while, I mean, we can interpret that broadly, I would appreciate if we tried to ask questions that, you know, are more directly relevant to the actual presentation. Yes? Well, first, then you can, both of you in turn. Please do identify yourself.
Kelsey Ross, master's student at American University. You touched on this a little bit when talking about ASEAN, but I was wondering sort of the big 10 that you had of ways to improve the Asian financial system. How do you expect countries to work together on these, or do you expect these reforms and improvements to be individual country made? And if so, how will those then work in a broader financial system?
Linnea Logie with the Stimson Center, and I was just wondering if you could comment on kind of the 20 to 30 year kind of perspective for Hong Kong and Singapore.
Maybe one more? Yeah.
Peter Bogert from the German Institutes of Global and Area Studies. You mentioned briefly issue of increasing debt. I recently read an Economist article, Asia was obviously in percent of GDP the clear master. All countries, Malaysia, China, you name them, were substantially above 150, 200% in total private sector debt. Obviously, we just said external debt seems to have decreased. Is in the book, there's, you know, statistics on that, showing that indeed the internal debt has increased vis-a-vis the external, because the overall private sector debt did not look very good to me.
All right. I think we can now take a turn. Why don't you start?
Okay, just to address your question on financial sector reform, I think this is the reform agenda for individual countries, but there is significant scope for Asian countries to work together. And they have various forums in which supervisors and regulators get together and exchange information and analysis. And one of the recommendations that the IMF make is that these supervisory, what we call supervisory colleges, should do that on a regular basis, and they should exchange information that is meaningful, and that they should do this regularly in normal times and not just in crisis times when, you know, there's a problem and then you scramble. So if you have a framework in place during normal times, it's much easier to coordinate when there is pressure in the financial sector.
You can pick which ones you're particularly would like to answer.
Let me answer the question about the ASEAN. Of course, the ASEAN is comprised of 10 countries, and then usually are tiered into two, ASEAN 5 and then CLMV. But even within each of these groups, they are very, very different in terms of the degree of, the financial deepening and the others. So in the first instance, they think about their own financial markets and then to come up with the solutions which best fits their, you know, specific circumstances. But on top of it, especially among the ASEAN 5, the more advanced countries, we have this, they are engaged in this initiative called ASEAN Bond Market Initiative, or ABMI for short. And then ADB is helping them coming up with certain collaborative approaches to develop the bond market and also cross-listing of the ASEAN countries with the various stock exchanges. So these regional initiatives are proceeding with the ASEAN. We call it ASEAN Plus 3, ASEAN and China, Japan, Korea cooperating with the each country official country authorities of the ASEAN countries to formulate this financial sector, mostly technical assistance. So these are ongoing. And then the debt, we do notice that one of the things we find encouraging is the development of the local currency-denominated bond markets. It used to be so-called the original sins or twin mismatches of which resulted in the Asian financial crisis is a mismatches of currency and duration. They tended to borrow short-term in U.S. dollars and then flip it over and lend to a long-term, long-dated assets denominated in their own local currencies. So when the banks have to refinance their borrowing, they cannot call back the long-term assets and local currency, so they were squeezed to come up with the U.S. dollar to repay it. So that was the basic cause of the Asian financial crisis. So learning from it, since the that day time, they have increased the instruments to borrow in a local currency. It's not entirely the result of a bona fide effect, that some of it is a result of the international investors' pursuit of yield. They wanted to have a higher yield, so and the U.S. dollar denominated rates are so low, so the U.S. Investors worldwide scrambled for the ASEAN country denominated debt, which has a nominally higher rate, and they thought that their currency should appreciate a little bit vis-a-vis the U.S. dollar. So in the context of like a 2010, just after the global financial crisis, there was an influx of money into the local currency-denominated bond. That increased the size of the local bond, and many corporations took advantage of cheap financing available in that market. That contributed to the increase in the corporate leverage. Again, aggregate number is important, but then in order for us to look at the financial stability issues, aggregate number is not that pertinent as I explained earlier. So what percentage of the firms have accumulated how much debt, and therefore how large a portion of the corporate sector is vulnerable, should interest rate go up by this much, and should the earning generally goes back down like much. So this is the kind of stress testing we will do. And then we are cautious about this general trend of increase in the corporate sector debt, and we'll be looking at it quite carefully in each country's situation.
Anything on Singapore and Hong Kong, or anything else, Ashwa?
Well, yeah, I was a mission chief for Singapore, but then. They are very nicely run country, tightly run countries. And then the Hong Kong is not exactly a country, but then HKMA has a very strong, their capacity-wise, they are very strong in looking at the economy and noticing any changes. So, 30 years is a long time to project, but then judging from the quality of the people there, I have no reason to doubt that they will be successful in the coming years. I may be too diplomatic, but that's...
I have no doubt that Mr. Talley and others care about the IMF's views about China, not mine, but I will take a bullet for my former IMF colleagues. On the currency issue, I think what the PBOC indicated it planned to do on August 11th of last year, which was to move towards a more flexible exchange rate, is going to be good for the PBOC, is going to be good for China. The initial step was not very well executed, and at this stage, I think it makes a lot more sense for China to use the flexibility somewhat more aggressively. But the issue again comes back to managing expectations in a very turbulent environment, because at this stage, with the government still intervening on and off in the markets, both in the onshore market and the offshore market, I think it's making things potentially somewhat worse. So what's a good exit strategy? I'm afraid there the answer is a complex one, and it goes back to what I talked about earlier and what is in the book. If you think about exchange rate policy or monetary policy in a vacuum, it does not work very well, because you need to have other things working well in the economy. There are concerns about the Chinese economy, so what would you need to stabilize expectations? You need a mix of macro policies, a little bit of monetary, a little bit of fiscal, preferably more fiscal policies, and you do need to show signs that there are going to be active steps taken to reform the real side of the economy. So unless you have those as confidence-building measures, I think it's going to be a very difficult struggle. And on the issue of debt, again, there tends to be a lot of focus on the level of gross debt in the Chinese economy, and the McKinsey numbers, for instance, which are now approaching 300% of GDP in China, do sound very scary. But as Mr. Sumi pointed out, one has to look behind the debt. One needs to look at what the financial system is that is intermediating that debt, what the maturity structure of the debt is, who's taken the debt, and what sort of activities that debt is financing. And I recommend the book to you to get a better sense of what is behind those debt numbers. So I think the issue for many of these countries, again, is not just the level of debt. In fact, having good, vibrant debt markets, bond markets in particular, is potentially a very good thing for the financial systems in this economy. It gives you the breadth that I spoke about as one of my, it wasn't a top 10 list, it was perhaps a timid 3 list, but I think those are the key characteristics one should think about. So in the context of many of these economies in Asia, again, the level of exposure to external debt, although there is some concentrated exposure of corporates in certain sectors, overall it is not a cause for panic as yet, although it does constrain many corporations and the macroeconomic policies in some of these countries, although, again, not anywhere near to the extent that it was before the Asian financial crisis. And I think the issue here is about developing better regulatory frameworks to make sure that whatever debt we do see in the economy does not necessarily portend significant problems when conditions like interest rates or exchange rates change. So I don't think it's a huge concern yet, but in a country like China, the level of debt and the fact that it's been intermediated through a financial system that's not been great at intermediation, since most of this debt is bank debt, I think that suggests that there is going to be an economic price to pay. Not, in my view, a crisis, but certainly a price to be paid.
Thank you very much. Okay, we have time for, yes, you and the gentleman there in the back later.
Hi, my name is Nian. I'm a first-year PhD student in economics at American University. And I have a question, because Mr. Aswar Prasad talked about the liberation of Chinese financial market. And my question is regarding the market mechanism right now in the stock market there. From what I know there, you can only buy long and cannot short in the market. And you buy today, you can only sell tomorrow. But comparing to the Western markets, they are free. Buy today, sell today. You can also sell the companies that not as efficient and not earning money. But what happens in the beginning of 2014, the slowdown in the Chinese economy bring down a lot of manufacturings for the exporting industries. And these financial capital flow into the financial markets after the slowdown in economy. So even these companies who are not as efficient, not making money, their stock price still keep going up. And then that was the, or do you think the environment would be less riskier if the Chinese government would make the market freer instead of being restricted?
Thank you. Last question over there, yeah.
My name is Dimitri. Thank you very much. Very interesting. My question also, unfortunately, is also for Dr. Prasad. I read your book recently. I thought it was a great book. Thank you very much. My question is, if I remember correctly, in the book you describe an inefficient but stable equilibrium with the dollar at the middle. Would you say that the development of the Asian financial system is leading us towards something better? Are we headed in the right direction in terms of this situation with the dollar's role in the global economy? Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe one more. That's the last then. Okay.
Hello, I'm Yvonne from Johns Hopkins. I just want to ask, how do you think the Asian Investment Bank will influence the Asia economic market or environment later? Thank you.
Okay, maybe I can add one last thing also that you may want to comment on. You know, one big debate in the financial supervision, regulation, financial stability board and all that is the banks are claiming that after the crisis, the regulators kind of have a tendency to overdo it in terms of capital cushion, leverage constraints and things like that. And others claim that quite the contrary, not enough has been done. Maybe you could say one or two words in the Asian context about this debate as well as anything else. And why don't we start with you, Ms. Lim?
I mean, to answer your question, I think the other questions were for my other panelists. I like to think of it as the story about Goldilocks and the three bears. And I would say that the global regulatory reform agenda has got it broadly right. So the porridge is not too hot, it's not too cold. And, you know, we're going to have lobby groups who will say, you know, it's going to increase the lending, the borrowing costs of banks, and therefore they're going to have to pass this cost on to consumers. We actually, in the book, did a study on this to see whether or not the impact of the global regulatory reform actually caused lending rates to increase in Asia, in Asian banks. And I think this is chapter 11 in the book, and we actually saw minuscule effect, maybe 10 to 25 basis points, but it wasn't something to write home about. So we think, as the IMF, that the global reform agenda has made the global financial system safer and stronger.
Very good. Good to hear. Mr. Sumi?
Well, I used to work for the Japanese FSA, and I have my personal opinions about the FSB and everything, but I refrain from it. Talking about the AIIB, answering your question, as we have explained that infrastructure investment need is huge, it's simply huge, and then infrastructure investment is a very productive investment, and then it has the potential of crowding in private sector investment. So developing countries usually lacks that funding mechanism for that needed infrastructure investment. So in that sense, any help to increase that infrastructure financing would be a nice thing. Except that if one lender lends to the existing borrower in a way that sort of not commensurate with other lenders' standards in terms of the credit worthiness or the integrity of the project, then my existing borrower will become at risk, right? So in a sense that if you make an investment decision, that has to be made in a transparent and way that reflects the shareholders' governance structure, which is, the shareholders of AIIB, many of them are the same as the shareholders of the World Bank and, other regional development banks. So if this, we can pretty much see the collaboration. We're looking forward to the collaboration with AIIB, which is run and sort of nicely with good governance and good selection of the project and so on. So we would welcome any help to finance this vast need to upgrade and solve the infrastructure bottleneck, which is constraining the growth on the supply side at the moment.
Thank you. Eshwar?
So let me preface my concluding remarks by again recommending to you this book. Clearly, the fact that all of you are here suggests that you care about Asia's finance, and it's clearly an interesting and dynamic region. And not only is the book a very good book for the policy wonks among you, but as Ms. Sumi pointed out, there is also Cliff Notes version at the beginning of each chapter, so you get the gist of what the book is trying to convey. And I think ultimately, getting finance right is important for any country, but especially in Asia, given the impact that China and the region as a whole is having on the world. And in response to a couple of the questions that came up, I think the issue also here is that ultimately there isn't much of a choice now that these economies have started on the road to more open capital accounts, towards more liberalized markets. I think getting caught in the middle of the road where you have some degree of market liberalization, but still the expectation that the government will intervene when things go bad, if you don't have the right sort of institutional supporting framework, you end up with a lot of volatility, but none of the benefits of market liberalization. And I think this book very nicely lays out the path towards the ultimate objective, both in terms of defining what the objective ought to be in terms of different aspects of financial market development, but also how to get there in a very good way. So I congratulate Ms. Lim, Mr. Sumi, and all their IMF colleagues for an excellent and timely book.
Very good. And we thank you for being here, for sharing the thoughts with us, and for coming to Brookings. Thanks a lot.